It was about what he could do for you. He didn't brag about good looks or extraordinary abs like most of the men featured there. He claimed to be a normal guy who blended with the crowd. But that suited her. She would have been too intimidated by anything more. One night was all he promised, and his lists of requests were full. As a flutter rose up inside her, she knew the boy-next-door type suited her just fine, even though her girl-next-door years were well behind her. At 55, life was slipping by, and the looks she worked so hard to maintain were fading. Unfazed by the age difference, Matthew had promised a night she would never forget. To step back into a time when she wasn't somebody's mother, somebody's friend, somebody's wife. The light chime of her doorbell broke into her thoughts. She cursed softly as her eyes lit on her Gucci watch and realized what time it was. Her best friend was typically early, no doubt unable to wait another second to hear all the juicy details of her future date. Slipping off the black backless dress, Cheryl placed it onto the hanger, having decided it would be her gown of choice for her date. Quickly pulling on her capri pants and blouse, she tiptoed barefooted down the stairs to answer the door. "Hannah," she said, composing herself. 10 years her junior, her lifelong friend appeared as excited about her date as she was. After giving her a quick squeeze, Hannah invited herself inside, the scent of Marc Jacobs' Decadence trailing in her wake. An ex-model, with long blonde hair and excellent skin, Cheryl both loved and loathed her friend in equal measures. At 5'2" and a size 14, she had spent half her life trying to emulate Hannah's glamour. She was fed up of being invisible when they walked into a wine bar together, and hearing of escapades she could only dream about. Tonight was all about her, and she was going to shine. Hannah arranged a cushion before draping herself onto the living room sofa. "Have you had your lips plumped?" Cheryl said, peering closer as she sat next to her friend. "I've always had them done, darling. Just got a little more filler this time. Stung like buggery, but Tom adores them." "Which one is Tom?" Cheryl said. "Is he the mechanic?" "No, that's Mike. Tom's the chef. You know, the guy with the tattoos. Want me to get you up a picture?" Cheryl snorted. "From what I remember, not many of your pictures include faces. Besides, I don't think my ticker could take any more excitement right now." "I'm so excited for you too," Hannah said, her voice dropping to a conspiratorial tone. "Are you happy with your choice? This Matthew sounds a bit dull to me." "His bio is anything but..." Cheryl took a deep breath to calm her nerves. "At least his sexual history isn't. But what about Gordon and the kids? I feel so guilty. If he knew what I was about to do..." Hannah rolled her eyes dramatically. "Oh, come on! Are you telling me Gordon hasn't strayed during his weekends away with the lads? What about that time they went to Amsterdam? You think they went there to pick tulips?" The Amsterdam trip was his brother's stag party, but Cheryl knew from his sheepish behaviour upon his return that Hannah was probably right. Lately, his weekends away were becoming more frequent, but she never had the heart to stop him. Despite everything, she still loved her husband. Working in the city was stressful. Gordon needed a release. Having never worked a day in her life, Cheryl could only imagine the pressure he was under. But these days, it seemed like everyone was having fun except for her. "You're right," she said, with a twinkle in her eye. "Besides, it would be a sin to waste the Brazilian." "You got it done," Hannah said, a mischievous smile broadening her lips. "Well done, you." Cheryl clasped her friend's hand as she burst into an embarrassed giggle. I don't know how you do it. I've never been so mortified in all my life. Sounds like Gordon's in for a treat. But not before you have your fun, eh? Hannah said. You're right, Cheryl said, feeling like a teenager again. It's just one night. What harm can it do? Chapter 8. Another briefing brought a sense of urgency, as a second possible victim had been made known. Officers were crammed shoulder to shoulder into the airless space, both uniformed and specialist, as well as the detectives assigned to the case. D.I. Downs stood before the whiteboard looking restless, hands in his pockets, back out, rubbing his chin, hands in his pockets again. Ruby wondered just how much he would love a drink right now. She shuffled into the room, giving him a reassuring nod. The pressures of handling a high-profile case were making itself known. The thoughts of the suspect claiming another victim would crawl like ants beneath his skin. To Ruby, it just fueled her determination to bring him in. The door clicked closed as the last of the officers filed in. D.I. Downs's voice boomed as he clapped his hands together. Right, let's get this show underway. Welcome to Operation Landslide. But first, a word of warning. It's been less than a day since the balloon has gone up, and already we've had to instigate investigations into officers accessing restricted material. He turned his head from left to right, his gaze taking in every person in the room. Just because this case involves a celebrity, it doesn't give officers the right to access sensitive material. Media liaison will deal with any inquiries from the press. Social media is a no-no. In fact, I don't even want you on Facebook while you're investigating this case. The team nodded in agreement. Word had already spread in the force with regards to the investigation. Each of them left a digital footprint, and it cemented the necessity to keep their computers locked and password protected at all times. Although mobiles and computers were usually fiercely guarded, it was a common prank for declarations of love to be sent from their email address to their senior officers on the one occasion they forgot. It had been a favourite trick of D.C. Ash Baker's when he was around. Ruby sighed. His absence was sorely felt. One of the more popular members of the team, she wished he was still with them. His replacement could not be any more different. D.C. Richard Moss was early 40s, wore sensible clothes, and was as boring as hell. But what he lacked for in personality, he made up for in knowledge, and Ruby was glad to have some stability in the team. D.C. Owen Ludgrove was at the forefront, bringing them up to speed with his investigations to date. He'd had a haircut, his wavy black hair now trimmed in a short back and side style. Ruby liked Luddy. He was a real asset to the team. She felt a pang of regret as she thought of the promotion opportunities that could become available to the young man so dedicated to the job, to someone who towed the line. DCI Warrow listened intently, her black bobbed hair swaying as she gave an occasional nod of the head. Ruby pulled a pen from her own messy bun before scribbling down the salient points. Luddy was still discussing the first victim and the computer that was seized from her room. The laptop's been interrogated and we've come up with a list of websites. It seems she wasn't too bothered about deleting her internet history, probably because she'd hidden the computer and didn't expect her husband to find it. He held the list before him, picking out the most relevant sites. In the days leading up to her death, she's visited shopping websites, bought shoes, and browsed internet dating. Her last visit online was 2 days before she disappeared. 2 days before? What about the evening of her date? Could she have deleted her internet history? Downs said. Luddy shook his head. No, the tech guys have interrogated her history and deleted files. There's no emails or private messaging either. What worries me more is the thought of a copycat, one who won't be so easily stopped. Downs's response elicited a series of mumbles around the room. It was as if he had read Ruby's mind. She took a deep breath before airing her views. We need to speak to the original Lonely Hearts killer, Mason Gatley. Find out who he's been talking to about the murders he committed. It would be easier to get an audience with the feckin' Pope than get in front of him, Downs replied. Ruby raised her eyebrows as if to say we'll see about that. She had an ace up her sleeve and contacts in the pipeline. As Downs sped through the briefing, officers were told to extend their bail returns and cancel any annual leave. The message was clear. Their commanding officers demanded 100% commitment to this case. Chapter 9. I wasn't expecting to see you here, Ruby said, a smile flitting across her face as she pulled off her leather jacket and hung it on the hook on the wall. Unlike her previous abode, she loved going home to her Dalston flat, which was made all the more welcoming when Nathan dropped in. His home, in Shoreditch, was huge in comparison, but Ruby did not complain about the amount of time he was spending at hers. I had time to spare, Nathan said, his head lowered over the bubbling pot on the hob. Dressed in black t-shirt and jeans, he looked more relaxed than she had seen him in years. And you're cooking, too. Is it my birthday? Standing behind him, Ruby slid her hands around his waist. She knew Nathan used cooking as therapy, a way of easing away the stresses of the day. Maybe, if you play your cards right, Nathan said, turning from the pot and gently kissing her on the mouth. She could taste tomato and red wine on his lips, and reluctantly allowed him to return his attention to the cooking pot. It's a bit late for pasta, mind, she said, checking her watch. It was 11 o'clock, but she was used to eating at all hours of the day and night. Well, somebody's got to look after you, he said dryly. Have you heard from Kathy today? Ruby said. Her daughter was never far from her thoughts. It had been a shock when Kathy had found them. At the time, giving her up for adoption seemed like the right thing to do. She and Nathan were just teenagers back then. But it had broken Ruby's heart to learn that Kathy had not found the loving family Ruby had dreamed of. Things had been strained when she came back into their lives, but slowly the gap between them had narrowed. I've been thinking, Ruby said. Maybe she should live with me. I don't like her being at your mum's. You never know who's going to turn up and the police are no stranger to her door. The place is like Fort Knox, Nathan said, in a steady and reassuring tone. You don't have to worry on that score. But I do, Ruby said imploringly. Every time something nasty comes in, I think about her and wonder if she's okay. Ah, so that's it, Nathan said. Something's rattled you at work. Normally, Ruby didn't reveal too much about her job, given they were working on different sides of the law. The Crosby family had been known to police for generations, evolving from racketeering and bank robberies to supplying Class A drugs to the elite. She knew Nathan had made a huge effort to clean up his act since they got back together, but it would be a long time before he could resist the draw of the underworld in which he was so deeply entrenched, especially if his brother Lenny had anything to do with it. It was a constant tug of war between Ruby and Lenny for Nathan's attention. For all of her efforts in keeping Nathan on the right side of the law, Lenny worked twice as hard to drag him back into the sewers. Ruby sighed, her thoughts weighing heavy on her mind. She could not hold herself responsible for Nathan, not when she had so much to do. Have you ever heard of the Lonely Hearts killer? He went to prison for murdering 6 women. Mason Gatley was his name. Nathan nodded in recognition before turning to switch off the hob. Lenny served time with him. Why? Ruby grimaced behind Nathan's back at the mention of his brother's name. It's a murder case I'm working on. It reflects that one from 10 years ago. She watched as Nathan plated up the food. She knew he was still listening to her because the subject matter guaranteed his attention. It's really grim, she said, pouring them both a glass of red wine from the bottle he had left breathing on the side. Our victim's ring finger was amputated when she was murdered. If that's not bad enough, the killer took 3 photos of her over 3 consecutive days, then sent the pictures, along with her finger, to her husband. Nice guy, Nathan said, carrying their plates to the table. Ruby knew he had seen worse things in his time. Nothing appeared to shock him anymore. Yes, but my boss is reluctant to spend too much time looking into the old case. I think there's a link and it's worth exploring. It would help if I could speak to Mason Gatley. Ruby sighed, wishing Nathan would say something. Nodding at the food, he signalled at her to eat. People that didn't know him perceived his silence as displeasure, but Ruby knew he only spoke when he had something valuable to say. This is good, she said, after tasting her first mouthful. But she was keen to continue her discussion of the case. She was about to ask her lover for a favour, and knew he might not necessarily approve. Mason Gatley met his victims through Lonely Hearts adverts in newspapers. Things have moved on since then. I've no proof, but I think our current killer is working online, probably through one of these dating apps or internet sites. God knows there's plenty of them around. Probably, Nathan said, pausing to sip his wine. His voice was deep and sexy, his physique bearing evidence of regular sessions in his private gym. Even now, he had the ability to make her blush when he fixed his gaze on her. Ruby swallowed another bite before carrying on. While we've only had one victim, that's one death too many. It's too violent and vicious, and I can't see the killer stopping there. Then again, maybe they're trying to make it appear like it's a copycat, to divert the attention away from them. It could be a one-off contract killing, but I need to be prepared in case this leads to more. To Ruby, the beginning of any investigation was like finding her way around in a darkened room. Each clue, no matter how small, could provide the tiniest chink of light. But Ruby didn't want to wait for spotlights in the blackness. She wanted to illuminate the room. Nathan patted his mouth with a napkin before leaning back in the chair. Why don't you just come out and ask me? Ask you what? Ruby said, trying her best to look surprised. Oh, come on, you never talk to me about work, much less let me in on a case. You're after something. What do you need? Ruby took another forkful, chewing in silence as she played him at his own game. Eventually, she swallowed, clearing her palate with a sip of wine. I want you to persuade Mason Gatley to see me in prison. Chapter 10 What's this I hear about you visiting Mason Gatley? Heavy-footed, D.I. Downs barged into Ruby's office, completely oblivious to the fact she was on the phone. After some late-night phone calls and a few strings pulled, it seemed the prison visit had been arranged. What? Oh, that, she said, ending her call to the tech department. Having just imparted the urgency of her request, her mind was racing forward to her next task. Yes, that, Downs said, brushing away what appeared to be pastry flakes from his grey striped tie. At what point were you going to ask my permission? If it pertains to the investigation, then you have got to get clearance from me. I was waiting until it was agreed, Ruby said, feeling her hackles rise. To be honest, I didn't think it would happen. He hasn't had a visitor in years, and it's only thanks to my connections that he's agreeing to meet. Downs frowned, apparently unwilling to drop the subject. Don't you think you should hold off and see how we progress with the investigation? You might not need to visit this guy. I won't be there long, Ruby said. It may just give us the answers we need. Downs raised his hands in protest. He had always been a gesticulator. From stomping around the office to waving his arms as he spoke, His body worked in unison to relay his passion for the job.
Ah, he'll only play with you.
Why should he help us? He's probably basking in the attention.
He'll just be a way of passing the time.
Ruby folded her arms, reminding herself she was talking to a senior officer. She wished she could make him see the bigger picture, but he was too long in the job to start taking advice now. Mason Gatley won't get much out of me. I know we're stretched, but we have competent officers who are working on finding our suspect online. She pointed in the direction of the window that offered a view of their team. Any one of them is capable of the tasks we've set. But I'm the only one granted an audience with Gatley. If I turn this down, I may not get another chance. So as long as I'm progressing the investigation, then it can only be a good thing.
As long as it's worthwhile, Downs said on the exhale.
Like I said, you watch yourself with that one. What about if I come along, see if he'll meet both of us?
You're joking me, aren't you? Ruby said incredulously. You handled the investigation that put him away. Besides, it's not as if I'm meeting him down some dark alleyway. He's safely tucked away behind bars.
Downs gave her a look to say she should know better than to think she was safe because Mason was locked up. Sometimes prison did not stop the worst of offenders. It only provided them more thinking time to orchestrate their heinous crimes from afar. Of that, they were both well aware. As Downs rose from his seat, Ruby squeezed his arm. She knew his concerns for her went way beyond a work relationship. He was her friend, her mentor, and, briefly, her lover, less than a year before. Her voice was soft and warm as she imparted some reassurance.
Hey, no need to worry. I just want to find out what he knows about Melissa Sherman and who he's been talking to about his past. It could be fellow prisoners, family members, even journalists for all we know.
She tilted her head to one side as she caught his gaze.
It's got to be worth a shot, hasn't it?
Downs shook his head.
According to prison liaison, he hasn't had visitors in years. His post is being monitored, and there's been no details of his case.
I don't get why you're so worried, Ruby said, searching his face for answers.
I've dealt with people like Mason before.
The thing is, you haven't, Downs replied, finally meeting her gaze.
Sure, you've dealt with the sort of people that give ordinary decent folk nightmares, but they're pussycats compared to Mason Gatley. He is the most evil, soulless, psychopathic bastard you could ever be unfortunate enough to meet.
Don't hold back, boss. Why don't you say what you really feel? But Ruby's smile died on her lips as she took in the expression on Downs's face.
Were there tears building up in his eyes? Just what was going on with him?
She cleared her throat. She needed to wrap up this conversation and get on with the day.
So I suppose I should ask you officially, can I go?
Well, I'm hardly going to say no to you now, am I? Downs said. Not when your boyfriend has gone to so much trouble to put you in front of harm's way.
Downs was one of the few people to know about Ruby's connection with the Crosbys. He had kept her secret, but it did not stop him voicing his disapproval when they were alone.
Ruby opened her mouth to complain, but Downs raised his hand.
Keep your phone switched on in case of developments. If anything crops up, I'll pull you out of there. And I want no arguments. Agreed?
Agreed, Ruby said. Downs nodded sharply before leaving her to her thoughts. Something was eating him, that much was clear, and from what Ruby could tell, it was personal.
Chapter 11. Sliding into the church pew, Matthew enjoyed the firmness of the wood against his knees in the second row. Church was the one place he could think without fear of interruption. Holding his rosary beads, he crossed his hands together, his eyes turned up to the stained glass display. Jesus on the crucifix, blood trailing down his face, hands, and feet as he gasped his last breath. Above him, the sky was grey and thunderous, a signal of what was to come. That was how Matthew had felt when he had picked up Melissa. A storm had rumbled within him for so long, his displeasure of the world fueling what was ahead. He bowed his head as he whispered words he had memorized from Isaiah 47:10. He felt sure they would reach her, now she had passed on to the other side. "And thou hast trusted in thy wickedness, and hast said, There is none that seeth me. Thy wisdom and thy knowledge, this hath deceived thee. And thou hast said in thy heart, I am, and besides me there is no other."
Pondering on his words, his fingers crept to the necklace beneath his shirt. He could feel the outline of Melissa's wedding ring nestled on his collarbone. It still carried a tiny streak of her blood. It had hardened now, clung to the metal band that meant so little to her. She did not deserve to wear such a sacred thing, but he did, because he was carrying out the Lord's work. He took comfort in the fact that there would be many more to come. A swell of love rose up inside him as he glanced at the stained glass depiction. Sometimes you had to do terrible things to make the world a better place. It was his duty to spread the message to every corner of the globe. The world had become a depraved pit of iniquity. He would finish what other brave souls had started, and soon his message would grow. There would be others like him, ordinary people with God in their heart. He closed his eyes, emitting a contented breath. Peace and calm replaced his tumultuous rage, but he knew that it would return. A newspaper article, something said online. His anger was a gift, a tool in his armory to propel him forward. Anybody that tried to stop him would soon become undone. He had greater powers than the law on his side. His phone buzzed a silent notification. He knew without looking it would be another married woman requesting his presence for the night. There were so many to choose from. He could kill every day if circumstances allowed. But no, he would follow the template that had been laid down before him. First a blonde, then a brunette, and then someone very special indeed. He would draw them in with promises of sex-fueled private parties that would make their head explode. Class A drugs brought a welcome cocktail for those willing to experiment. All thoughts of Melissa behind him, his mind wandered forward to tonight's date. He would check in early this time and hide the rucksack in his room. It had not been easy carrying out his plan. But sometimes when God wanted you to grow, he made you feel uncomfortable. He threaded the rosary beads between his fingers, pressing down on each wooden ball as he drew strength. Now his first kill was complete, things would get easier from here. A tingle of excitement shot through his body at the thought of what was to come. His passion for God's work was a thrill like no other. He would do him justice, inflict a wrath so terrible it would carry his message to the four corners of the earth. Pocketing his beads, he stretched his hands out either side, tilting his head back as he opened his palms wide. Searching the murky passages of his mind, he tried to imagine himself nailed to the cross. He could almost hear the sound of steel on steel, feel the nails as they drove through his flesh. He squeezed his eyes tight, picturing the crown of thorns spearing his skin, rivulets of blood running down his face. "Use me," he whispered, his words echoing through the church. "Use me as a vessel for your work." He closed his eyes tightly,
waiting for a response that only he could hear. As a side door creaked open, a priest entered, his head bowed in prayer. Matthew dropped his hands to his side, rising from his knees. He'd received his answer. He knew what he had to do. Chapter 12. The computer screen reflected against Ruby's reading glasses as she absorbed the information to date. Briefing had been swift, and as their investigations had failed to reap answers, DCI Warrow had given the prison visit her blessing too. Now each detail of Mason Gatley's crimes were laid bare before her, as Ruby refreshed herself with details of the case. The last thing she wanted was to encounter any nasty surprises when they met. The thought made her nerves jangle deep inside. Her DI's words had spooked her. Mason Gatley was quite clearly a psychopath, with no feelings or remorse for his crimes. But she had dealt with people like him in the past. Why was Downs so nervous about this meeting? Unlike some of their previous offenders, he was safely tucked away behind bars. But as she read details of each grisly death, she felt her flesh creep. Reluctantly, her gaze returned to the photos and the chilling speed at which the subject's features changed from happiness to undiluted horror. With coy smiles, they posed for the first photo, their eyes carrying a hint of flirtation. How Ruby wished she could go back in time and warn these women before it was too late. Pretty yet understated, they did not appear to have a wide knowledge of the outside world. From their biographies, they were bored and lonely, but cheating was not a common practice in their lives. Their first foray into the world of adultery would tragically be their last. Ruby moved on to the second lot of scanned photos, their terror clear to see. The whites of their eyes flashed before the camera, their teeth bared as they drew back their lips from the gag in an effort to scream. It filled Ruby with both horror and searing anger. Why couldn't he have left it there? He got what he wanted, terrified these poor women. Why did he have to delay the agony by killing them the next day? She nibbled on her bottom lip, chewing away the Ruby Woo red lipstick she had applied an hour before. Would an insight into Mason Gatley's mind provide answers in relation to this modern-day killer? The responsibility felt like a physical weight being placed on her shoulders. Sure, she was part of a greater team. But it would be her staring into Gatley's eyes, her face in his thoughts as he slept. Was he instructing the new killer? Was she putting herself directly in the line of fire? She clicked through the last of the photos, snapped mercilessly after death had claimed its victims. Molly, aged just 23, the top button of her blouse undone. Blood seeped into the crumpled white material as it trickled down from the wound where the rope had bitten into her throat. Her head slumped to one side. She sat against the headboard of the four-poster bed. A sign was propped against her chest, the word SLUT, emblazoned in jagged red letters. Just like Melissa, the ring finger of her left hand was missing, with nothing but a bloodied stump in its wake. A red trail of blood had seeped into the bed linen and turned it a merlot red. Tina, aged 50, was featured in the third lot of photos, and Ruby shuddered as she took in her dead-eyed stare. Another placard was propped against her, the word whore bleeding red across its surface. On and on the photos went. Each victim treated the same as the one before. Each profanity voiced the killer's thoughts as the camera clicked for his satisfaction. How they had managed to keep them out of the press during the investigation, she didn't know. Perhaps it had been easier back then, without the aid of camera phones and grisly online sites too keen to share.
It made her all the more assured that whoever the killer was, they must have had eyes on these pictures, or at least know someone who could provide a vivid description capable of invoking a chilling reenactment in the present day. Ruby clicked, unblinking, through the remainder of the photographs, hoping the families had been spared from seeing the brutality inflicted upon their loved ones. How torn they must have felt, coming to terms with their infidelity as well as their murders. Had they gotten on with their lives? Married again? Such vile acts touched everyone involved, putting each family member through their own life sentence as they carried their loss for the rest of their days. Broken husbands, damaged children, and then the parents who had buried their young. Ruby had seen it all before, but this crime seemed to go that one step further, involving the loved ones by inflicting further pain. Why else would he send their amputated finger in the post? Is that what he got off on? The ripple effect of such monstrosities? Knowing he had stained their souls with evil so dark that it would never be removed? She worked through the evidence, switching her focus to the officer statements and interviews that followed. Pleading guilty, Mason showed no remorse, but the families were spared the stresses of trial. She read through the file, searching for the conclusion. Mason Gatley had been caught in the act after murdering his sixth victim. Ruby's eyes flicked from left to right while she digested the text. Mason had killed just the week before, but believing he was unstoppable, was already en route to another hotel as part of his murderous spree. It was thanks to a quick-thinking officer that he was stopped at the scene. His final victim had been a decoy police officer, and she had gleaned enough information to discover his whereabouts that day. Such was the ferocity of his attacks that the blood was barely dry on his hands before he plotted his next kill. Even then, he had plenty of women to choose from, and an array of letters were later found at his house. Ruby continued to read, relieved to discover that the decoy police officer had been unharmed. Spotted by a plainclothes officer in the hotel corridor, Mason Gatley was followed as he got wind of the police and abandoned his date. The tiny red stain on the cuff of his shirt sleeve could have passed for any number of things, but it gave the observant officer enough concerns to follow the man to the roof. It was there that Mason picked up the rucksack containing the rope he had used to murder one of his victims earlier that week. So Mason was caught, all because he could not bear to leave without the precious rope that meant so much to him. Exhaling a long, slow sigh, Ruby felt a little bit better. It was easy to identify with the killer as some inhuman monster, impervious to their efforts to stop him in his tracks. But killers were people, and people made mistakes. Chapter 13. Mason Gatley used every inch of his 6'6" frame as he walked into the room. Unlike many of his fellow inmates, he had not allowed the system to grind him down. His hair, now shoulder length, was slightly kinked but clean, the mousy brown streaked with wavy rivers of grey. The tip of his beard ended below his chin, but it was all lost on Ruby because she was hooked into his gaze. Gatley was not a handsome man, yet he held a presence that was hard to escape. "Detective Sergeant Preston, I presume," Mason said, his chair screeching against the tiled floor. There were no barriers between them in the sterile interview room, but a nearby member of staff was keeping a close eye on them both. Like several other rooms around them, the top half of the walls comprised see-through protective glass. Such transparency was welcome when dealing with a serial killer with a thirst for blood. "Thank you for agreeing to see me," Ruby replied in a formal tone, seeing little point in wasting time. When it came to murder cases, every second, every word, every syllable of conversation was precious. She could not help but think that some terrible fate awaited some poor soul as she sat here. She was not going to make small talk.
"I can tell you how nice it is to have some female company."
Mason settled into his chair, voicing his thoughts in an almost theatrical manner.
"I get fan mail and pen pal requests from women all over the world, even a proposal or two. But they're just ghouls, you know. They look at me with morbid curiosity. They don't see me for who I am."
"And I do?" Ruby finished his sentence, keen to move on. Mason delivered a slow nod of the head, the corners of his mouth turning upwards in a smile. He seemed pleased with her, although she was yet to figure out why. "Mason," Ruby said, wondering if the man ever blinked, "is it okay if I call you by your first name?"
"Of course," Mason replied. "As long as I can call you Ruby."
"Sure," Ruby said, figuring she needed to build up rapport. "Do you know why I'm visiting you today?" Mason began to stroke his beard.
"You want my advice on a murder which has all the hallmarks of mine."
Ruby did not disagree. "I can't disclose too many details, but it's similar to the murders you committed 10 years ago. Do you know why anyone would want to copy you?"
"I know lots of things," Mason said. "And I can see you're in a great hurry to find out what. But this is a two-way deal. I don't sell my soul to just anyone."
"What do you want from me?" Ruby asked. "Because if you're unhappy with your living conditions, I'm not sure there's much I can do."
"I came to terms with my surroundings a long time ago," Mason said.
He pointed to his temple.
"It's what's in here that needs stimulating."
"I'm no shrink," Ruby said.
"I don't need you to be."
Calmly, he assessed her, allowing precious seconds to pass before continuing.
"Try to imagine living in a room the size of a shoebox, with no communication from the outside world. Every day is Groundhog Day, and the people you do come in contact with don't exactly provide scintillating conversation. I'm in need of a change, and you are that change."
"I'm a police officer," Ruby said. "I think it's important we don't lose sight of that, don't you?" Mason chuckled, giving her a look that said he knew better.
"From what I've heard, you've lost sight of your position more than once. I served time with Lenny, you know. Now, he was an interesting sort. I don't think I've met anyone who hated the world as much as him."
Ruby folded her arms and leaned back in her chair. "Don't believe everything you hear. Look, as much as I'd like to chat, there's also an issue that's a matter of urgency I need to talk to you about. Do you know anything about the murder of Melissa Sherman?" Tutting, Mason shook his head.
"Just when we were getting along so well. I'm afraid if you want information from me, you're going to have to wait for it."
Ruby set her jaw in frustration. She could almost hear a clock ticking backwards in her head. "I don't have time. My visit is on work hours. If you can't help me, then I'll go." Inhaling deeply through his nostrils, Mason leaned forward.
"I didn't say I couldn't help you. I only said you have to wait. You haven't asked me yet."
"I've asked you twice," Ruby said, her frown growing as her patience ran thin.
"No, you haven't asked me the question, the one everyone wants to know."
Mason craned his neck, his veins bulging as he whispered his words.
"Why did I kill?"
Ruby exhaled tersely, her tone flat, If such antics were meant to intimidate, she was not playing along. Let me guess. You had a bad childhood. You were dumped by your ex. Some sad story along those lines. Life was hard. You got angry. Need I go on?
So you think I killed those women out of a thirst for revenge?
Mason said, leaning back in his seat. Ruby nodded in response, having heard it all before. Jabbing the table with his finger, Mason spoke with ill-concealed disgust.
That's what gets me. People read the news reports, watched me in court, and they made their own opinions just like you. But they're wrong. You want to know why I did it?
Ruby inhaled a deep breath, refusing to leave his gaze. Enlighten me. A salacious smile widened Mason's face.
Because I enjoyed it, of course.
Ruby fought to keep her expression neutral. She felt the heat of his glare, and it made her squirm in her chair. She uncrossed her legs, making preparations to go. She would not allow pond scum like Mason Gatley to make a chink in the defense of the wall she had carefully built around her. This visit isn't about you. It's about your opportunity to do something good in your life. You said you know something. I've been here 10 minutes and I'm no further on. So how about you stop wasting my time and give me something to go on?
You've got guts. I like that, Mason said. Have you ever heard of the butterfly effect?
Sure, it's cause and effect. A metaphor on how the smallest natural causes, such as the beating wings of a butterfly, can have a profound effect.
Eloquently put. Think of me as the butterfly. They may have plucked my wings, but I'm still able to whip up a storm.
So you're saying that you've orchestrated these murders? Ruby said, her eyebrow involuntarily arching.
Inadvertently. Someone has been inspired by my acts, wouldn't you say?
I can't disagree with you there, Ruby said. The question is, who? Mason threaded his fingers together and leaned forward on his hands.
Will you come back to visit me?
Are you saying I'll need to? Mason bared his teeth in a smile.
I'd like you to. I'll tell you what, how about I give you something to go on, at least until our next visit?
Go ahead, Ruby said. Examine the details of my past kills with a fine-tooth comb. Compare what's been said to the press and what the cops kept back.
Then examine the recent murder and see what your killer knows.
You're saying that our killer knows intimate details of the case? Ruby's eyes narrowed. And that there'll be more murders to come, am I right? Mason nodded, his eyes never leaving Ruby's.
You're a very attractive woman, but I don't get why you're mixing with criminals. Surely someone with your intelligence should be higher in the ranks by now.
It's my job. I mix with criminals all the time, Ruby said dryly. And the information you've given isn't anything more than I already know.
Ah, it's early days, Mason replied. I hope when you return, we'll get to hear a little more about your background. Let's see if I can dissect you better than you attempted to with me.
I won't be coming back, Ruby said. We're going to catch this killer, and that will be the end of it. Perhaps the pair of you can share a cell.
Humor, too. I like it. Have you ever been tied up, Ruby? Had a rope around your neck so tight that you couldn't breathe?
Goodbye, Mr. Gatley, Ruby said, rising from her chair.
See you next time, Mason replied.
Chapter 14.
Shoving her bag beneath her chair, Anne gave her colleague, Jean, a knowing smile. Today had been hectic, and she was looking forward to sitting down for a few hours. With the kids tucked up asleep in bed, and her husband Carl watching the footy, she was free to forget her own world for the rest of her shift.
"Busy?"
she said, keeping her voice low so as not to disturb the other call-takers.
"It's not been too bad,"
Jean said, masking a cough with the back of a liver-spotted hand.
"No suicides, although this cough will be the death of me. I'll be glad to get home."
"More like those cigarettes," Anne said, smoothing down her rain-drenched, cropped blonde hair. "Have a good evening. Take care." Jean had been volunteering at Sanity Line for what felt like forever, but Anne had a feeling that ill health would bring her stint to an end. There was more to that cough than she was letting on. There was little time to dwell on it as the telephone rang for her attention. Unwinding the scarf from around her neck, she rested it on the back of the chair before taking a seat. "Hello, Sanity Line, can I help you?" Silence followed, so Anne waited patiently for a response. In the background, a television blared, and from the sound of it, the same football match her husband was ensconced in front of was on at the other end of the line as well. A low voice broke into her thoughts. "Oh, hi. I don't have to give you my name, do I?" a male voice replied.
"Not if you don't want to,"
Anne said, crossing her legs beneath her chair. "I was wondering if it's okay for me to be calling you like this. I'm not suicidal or anything. I feel a bit guilty about taking up your time when you could be dealing with needier cases." Anne nodded into the phone. It was a common misconception that you had to be suicidal to contact them. "We value all our calls. How are you feeling today?" The caller sighed. "Disjointed. Tied up in knots. I've nobody to talk to. Well, nobody that would understand."
"You can talk to me," Anne said. "It might help."
A slight hesitation ensued, followed by a deep exhalation of breath. "Would you, though? Are you married? Have you ever cheated on your other half?" Anne shuffled in her chair as she made herself comfortable. She thought of Carl and hoped he wouldn't drink too much tonight, not while he was minding the kids. She returned her focus to the call. "Is that what happened to you? Why don't you tell me about it?" A sudden cheer erupted from the football game in the background, and Anne guessed that someone must have scored a goal. She hoped it was West Ham. Carl would be in a pig of a mood if they lost.
"Hello? Are you there?"
she said, presuming her caller was watching the game too. "Sorry," they replied. "I was looking for the remote. Here, let me turn this down." Muting the background calamity, he continued. "I met someone, you see. Well, when I say met, we've spoken a few times online. Her name is Cheryl, but she's married." A short, exasperated sigh followed. "Which is why she shouldn't be talking to me. Do you think I'm crazy, getting all het up over someone I've not even met?" Anne smiled. How sweet, her caller was in love. But it was not up to her to give an opinion, only listen to what they had to say. "You say they haven't met you yet?" The response was instant. "Not in that way, but they will. I've been getting ready, making sure everything's just right for our date. I suppose you could call me an old-fashioned soul. I want it to be perfect, you know. That takes time. Planning." Anne nodded into the phone. Her days of being wooed ended as soon as Carl pushed an engagement ring on her finger, a hasty response to their first unplanned pregnancy. Her caller was still talking, and she murmured encouraging noises to show she was listening to them. "I'm going to give her the night of her life. Then I'm going to make her wish she never strayed."
"Really?"
Anne said, her initial friendliness fading away.
It wasn't easy, choosing just one when there were so many offers. But I had a template to follow, from someone who's inspired me. Someone who's been there before. A frown furrowed Anne's brow. Her voice was reassuring and non-judgmental, but her facial expressions were her own. "I'm sorry, I don't understand. Can you explain a little more?" she said, gently probing. "No, other than to say I have it all planned." A smile carried on the caller's voice. "I don't expect them to understand right away. Sometimes people just don't know the difference between right and wrong. It's up to me to show them the way." Tiny alarm bells began ringing in Anne's mind. She reminded herself that she was not one to judge. "Is there something concerning you about your feelings towards Cheryl? I'm guessing you rang me for a reason. Perhaps it would be good to talk things through." She waited for their response, hoping she had not crossed the line. They were there to listen, not pick things apart. She did not have to wait long for an answer. "I'm worried they won't make it easy for me. People, they don't always get me to begin with. I guess I'm calling because you've helped me in the past. I couldn't sleep. I still had your number, so I thought I'd give you a ring." There were so many questions rising in Anne's mind. Who was their caller? What were their intentions? All this talk about templates and punishment, what were they planning to do? "You've rung us before," she said, knowing she should stick to the rules, ask them how they're feeling and leave it at that. Not all her callers made sense. It could be down to drugs or mental health issues, even making up stories for an excuse to talk. A feeling of helplessness tempered her thoughts. There was something about her caller that felt off-kilter. "I've rung in the past." The sense of happiness that imbued the caller's voice now evaporated. "It was a very dark time for me then. But things are better now. How are you? Are you having a busy night?" Anne checked her watch. "We don't get as many calls after midnight. Is there anything else you'd like to talk about?"
"No,"
he yawned. "I feel a bit silly now. I just needed to talk. It will all work out. I'm prepared." As the caller hung up, Anne gently placed the phone handset back on the receiver. She had taken far worse calls, from people in deep despair, but this caller had set her on edge. She imagined a watcher following their intended victim, their final words ringing in her ears. "I'm prepared." Chapter 15. "That Mason Gatley's a piece of work," Ruby said, throwing the car keys onto her desk. D.I. Downs had followed her in, looking slightly harried as the team raced to complete their tasks. "Any developments?" she asked, eyeing him as he opened a Tesco bag and unwrapped a tuna and sweet corn sandwich. "That's what I was going to ask you," he said, offering her half. Ruby took it gratefully, catching Luddy's eye through the window and making the tea sign with her hands. She did not always treat him as the tea boy, but today she felt like she was running on empty. She watched him delegate the task to Richard, the newest member of the crew. Ruby smiled. He was learning. "Sorry," she replied. "It was an interesting visit, but it didn't bear fruit." She took a seat, glad to slip off her heels and take the weight off her feet. She had dressed sharp today, a show of empowerment in her crisp white shirt, black suit, and matching black heels. She could still see Mason Gatley in her mind's eye, his face difficult to eradicate from her thoughts. "He was watching me like I was his next meal. He has a real big opinion of himself, too. I think he gets a kick out of frightening people, making them see how monstrous he is." "He is a monster," Downs said,
pushing his empty sandwich wrapper back into his Tesco bag. And you'd do well to remember that. Be careful what you say to him, especially about your private life. He's still got contacts on the outside,